Welcome to Holy Unhappiness, conversations about the expectations we have of what the life of faith will feel like. I'm your host, Amanda Held Opelt, author of the book Holy Unhappiness, God, Goodness, and the Myth of the Blessed Life. Each week, I'll be speaking with writers, pastors, artists, and friends about the myths we believe about the good life. Together, we'll reimagine what blessing can look like if we are willing to look beyond our culture's definition of happiness and success. Welcome. I'm glad you're here. This is the last episode of our series on mental health that we've done in honor of Mental Health Awareness Month in May. And I just want to thank all my guests for all their insights, for the work that they do in the world on this important topic. And for my listeners, in case you haven't heard this enough, if you or someone you love is struggling, seek help. You are not alone. There is hope and there is community for this journey. For my last guest, I wanted to invite the person on who has written probably one of my favorite books about the nitty-gritty reality of struggling with mental health, specifically as a person of faith. And that is Dr. O. Alan Noble, who wrote the book On Getting Out of Bed, The Burden and Gift of Living. Dr. Noble is an associate professor of English at Oklahoma Baptist University, advisor to Christ and Pop Culture and the AND campaign. And he's the author of three books, the one I just mentioned, On Getting Out of Bed, another book called You Are Not Your Own, Belonging to God in an Inhuman World, which that one might be in my top five most influential books that I've read in the last like 10 years. I don't know. I love that book. And his other book, another awesome book, is A Disruptive Witness, Speaking Truth in a Distracted Age. Dr. Noble has published articles at The Atlantic, Vox, First Things, and Christianity Today. He lives with his wife and three children. And I want to thank Dr. Noble especially because I had some technical difficulties while we were recording. My internet was really in and out. And I am assuming that's because it was raining really hard outside. But frankly, I don't know how the internet works. I don't know if rain would cause that to happen. But for whatever reason, it was a technically challenging session. And I had to stop it and restart it several times. And he was very patient and very pleasant. But I think we were still able to capture some really important insights from him. So thank you, Dr. Noble. And I'm excited for you all to hear from him today. Well, Dr. Alan Noble, it is so exciting to have you on the podcast. Thanks so much for agreeing to be on and for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So whenever people ask me who my favorite authors are right now, I very often mention you. Your two books, On Getting Out of Bed and You Are Not Your Own, are some of the two, I think, my two favorite books from the last 5 years. And people ask me, like, what are the most influential books you've read in the last 5 years? I always mention You Are Not Your Own, and I mention Tara Isabella Burton's Strange Rites. I'm like, read those two books, and it will explain everything about why we are the way we are as a society right now. So really appreciate your work. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that.
So, I was hoping that you could tell us a little bit of, you know, tell our listeners just a bit about your latest book, On Getting Out of Bed, and why did you feel a need to write that book?
Yeah, so I was going through my own mental health challenges at the time, and that was weighing on me. And in addition, there was a pastor that I knew of who took his own life, and tragically, and it got me thinking about what suicide communicates to other people and what persevering despite suffering communicates to other people. And it seemed to me that sort of the conclusion that I came to was that when we choose to suffer and greatly with mental affliction, but persevere, we communicate to other people that life is worth living, even though it's hard. Mm-hmm. And that's a powerful message. And so it sort of started from that seed and then grew from there.
Mm. Yeah, I think what I loved about that book is that, well, I have to admit, I kind of, when I finished it, I threw it against the wall, I think. I said to my husband, I was like, oh my goodness, Tim, Alan Noble said very precisely and very efficiently in 110 pages what I struggled to say very incoherently, I'm afraid, in about 280 pages in my own book. But it's just this idea that I think that you communicated so well, that life is hard. You're going to experience difficult feelings as a result of the very real and ordinary challenges of being human. And that's okay. That's actually part of life. That there's nothing wrong with you. You're not broken. You've not necessarily done anything wrong. That these are just the feelings that we often have. And this choice to continue to put one foot in front of the other is such a holy and God-honoring choice, is a huge success in and of itself, just to say yes to living. I found that to be so inspiring, and such a good pastoral word for those struggling with mental health challenges. You know, there's a lot out there psychologically and scientifically and all that from the mental health world, but to have a pastoral word like that, I thought was particularly poignant and helpful. And I was wondering, so you talk about kind of, you know, the real mental health challenges that people face. What I want to hear from you are, like, what are some of the features you think of modern America that have created such an anxious generation? And so, in other words, I basically want you to give us the elevator speech for the book You Are Not Your Own, which this is where you write more about that. But tell us a little bit about what is going on in our culture that's making it particularly an anxious time.
Yeah, great question. So the basic thesis of You Are Not Your Own is that we live in an environment that was designed with a false idea of what it means to be a human being in mind. And because it had that false anthropology, it naturally creates stress, anxiety, tension, frustration, depression. It's just a natural byproduct. And that false anthropology is this idea that you are your own and you belong to yourself. And out of that idea comes this obligation of belonging to yourself, what I call the responsibilities of self-belonging, where you have to carry things like, for example, identity on your shoulders. You have to craft an identity, promote an identity, create a brand for yourself, define yourself, constantly be promoting yourself in order to feel like you are a person, that you exist in the modern world. And that's an exhausting and unbearable burden that people have to deal with. When we understand that we belong, that we are not our own, but belong to God, then I think we rightly understand that we belong to communities, and that gives us connection. We belong to the church, that gives us hope. We belong to God. There are all these kinds of belongings that naturally flow out of belonging to God that I think can help deal with these pressures that we're experiencing. And of course, one of the big pressures is, especially for younger people, is social media. And when you are your own and you belong to yourself, there is this obligation to be on social media, to promote yourself, to feel alive, to feel validated. And that's often what people go on social media to do, is to feel validated and to distract themselves from themselves. And so I think it flows out of this false anthropology.
So yeah, I'd actually love to hear you talk a little bit about this like health and wellness industry that we have now that kind of gives us this idea that we can life hack our way to like a perfectly emotionally healthy, balanced life. Do you think that's working for us or working against us? What are your reflections on that?
Yeah, so this speaks to something called technique that we all experience in the modern world. Technique is the maximization of efficiency in every sphere of human existence. That's what Jacques Ellul says. And so it's this idea that you have to do the most efficient thing possible at every point in your life, which means that you have to eat the most healthy, economic lunch possible, the most nourishing breakfast possible, that you have to do the most efficient workout, the proper number of days. And that's where you get apps that adjust your workouts to, you know, exactly what your needs are and how your body looks and all these sorts of things. And what it does to us is it creates this inhuman pressure to be self-optimizing all the time. And part of what's so challenging about it is that everything has this burden. Everything feels like a moral obligation to be perfect. And it would be one thing if it was just people saying you need to eat a healthy diet and that was it. But it's you need to eat a healthy diet, you need to exercise, you need to take care of your kids this certain way, you need to get this amount of sunlight, you need to eat these, you know, take these supplements, you need to do this, you need to do that, you need to see the doctor, you need to take care of your mental health. There's always all these obligations. And if you're not doing it, the assumption is that you're not living a flourishing, full, happy life, that you're somehow insufficient. And that's overwhelming. And so what it does to us is it creates a sense of guilt. I'm teaching a novel right now called White Noise. It's a postmodern novel. And in it, there's this mother figure who knows that she should diet. So she's having lunch, and she instead of eating the lunch that she wants to have, she eats something that tastes better. And she says, you know, I know I should eat wheat germ and yogurt, but I just can't do it. And her daughters say, you know, point out that she always does this. She feels guilty if she doesn't buy the healthy food. She feels guilty when she sees the healthy food in the refrigerator and doesn't eat it. She feels guilty when she throws it out. There's this constant sense of guilt that I think contemporary people deal with. And in part, it's because we're told to maximize our efficiency to become these self-optimized individuals.
Yeah. I love that. I love this idea that like now it's almost like this is the wellness culture, the self-help, this self-improvement, this upward, you know, that what is that? Like this feature of modernity that we're always moving upward, we're always improving, we're always getting better, is almost like a new religion. And I can't remember if it was you who said, I mean, it sounds like something you would say. Maybe it was you, maybe it was someone else who said something like, whenever religion goes away, whenever religion is lost, or kind of our larger spiritual meta narrative is lost, then we have to replace it with something. We have to replace it with the kind of the rituals that a religion provides, or the meaning or the purpose that a religion provides. And I think in many ways that has been replaced by this idea that we can achieve wellness and self-awareness and you know, kind of the optimal life through all of these kind of hacks that are available to us now. And it can be exhausting, because at the end of the day, there's a huge difference between self-awareness and self-reform. And I don't, I think you say this pretty often, that it's not really a project we can undertake on our own. I actually think it requires a divine intervention in order to achieve, I don't even like the words achievement. That's a pretty 21st century American term, but to kind of reach that place of wholeness. I didn't send you this question in advance, so I'll spring it on you, but I'm curious if you think, like, as it maybe seems kind of simple question, but do you think God wants us to be happy? Or in other words, like, what do you think what is the balance between kind of understanding that the life of Christ, life with Christ, is a life of taking up your cross, but it's also a life in which he does reform our emotions and center them around what it means to truly live as an image bearer of God. What's kind of the balance there of understanding the suffering that comes in following Christ, but also the joy?
Yeah, I think he ultimately wants us to be happy. It's just that sometimes happiness has to go through suffering. And we can have this sense of joy and contentment within suffering, even as we feel paradoxically discontent with suffering. But I do think that he desires us to be happy in if we define happiness in a very specific way as a kind of fullness of being as designed by God, not happiness as like a fuzzy feeling in your stomach or an absence of stress or anxiety, but something deeper and more profound. I think we do pursue that kind of happiness, and I think that God wants us to, and that it's appropriate. But it is held in tension with these, as you talked about earlier, these normal life circumstances, which are just hard. And part of the task of being Christian is walking through those circumstances and holding on to faith and knowing that God is with you.
Mm-hmm. You write in On Getting Out of Bed that peace is sometimes an action based on faith and not an emotional state. Could you unpack this a little bit more? How do you think your perceptions of peace have changed over the years?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, so what I want peace to be is just emotional calmness. And that's the peace that I want to have, because that's what feels good. But I think real peace is often an action more than a feeling. And what I mean by that is that we have to take steps of faith that are steps of peace. So in other words, when you are feeling overwhelmed with anxiety, instead of giving into that anxiety and worrying, you take a step of peace. You act in peace by choosing to be present with your family, by choosing to do the work that God has put before you. It's an act of faith, but I think that's where peace lives, in these actions that we take, enacting the peace that we know that God has given us. Because our feelings are deceptive. They come and go, but our actions speak louder than our feelings, and our obligation is to what we can act, what we can choose to do with our lives.
You know, part of the reason I wanted to interview you for this month, where we're focusing on Mental Health Awareness Month, is because you do write so beautifully and pastorally about how there is such an incredibly important place for clinical mental health resources, medication. Sometimes people walk through very real mental health challenges in their life, and that can't be just reduced to maybe, well, you need to just stop sinning, or you need to just correct your theology, and then you're going to be totally fine and you're going to feel the right way. I think, what would you say to a Christian who is struggling with maybe a feeling of guilt or shame over the difficult emotions that they're experiencing, the mental health challenges that they're experiencing? What would you say to them as a pastoral word?
It's a great question. Yeah. So the first thing I would say is, I'm sorry that this is so hard, and there is no reason for you to feel ashamed. Mental illness is an affliction that affects many of us, just like other illnesses that affect our bodies. And there's no shame in that. And God is going to work through through this to help you, to guide you, to give you the peace that you need. But your task is to be faithful to him and advocate for yourself to get the help that you need, to get the emotional support that you need, the community around you to get yourself healthy. And asking for help is also not something to be ashamed about, because when you ask for help, it's an act of love to other people. You're giving them the opportunity to love you. And that's a blessing to them, whether they know it or not. And so your feelings of guilt and shame are not only misplaced, but they're also helping to keep you into this place of darkness. Because as long as you are, you know, beating up yourself for your mental health struggles, you're not going to be able to get on the path of recovery, because you're going to be so absorbed with the suffering that you can't address the suffering. So I understand those feelings of guilt and shame, but it's important to let those go. You need to let those go and accept that God loves you and he's caring for you, and there is a path to recovery, and your job is to be an advocate for yourself and pursue that path.
Well, I think that's a good word. And again, I just want to thank you so much for your work. There's a quote that I really love from On Getting Out of Bed. So I'm going to do the thing where I read your own words to you and try to make you feel as uncomfortable as possible. you say, each morning you must choose to get out of bed or not. All the medication and cognitive therapy and latest research and self-care in the world can't replace your choice. This decision can be aided by these resources, but never replaced by them, which means that you have to answer to a fundamental question: why get out of bed? Or more bluntly, why live? And I think that often reminds me of the words of Paul, which is, for me to live is Christ. And I think in a world where we are just told that unless we're living our best lives, we're not measuring up, just the simple choice to get up and change your kid's diaper and feed your dog and show up at work is such an incredible act of bravery. And I think that you've inspired a lot of people that sometimes good enough is enough for the day.
And
the Lord is pleased with that effort. So thank you for articulating that so beautifully.
You're
in
welcome.
Your book.
Thanks for having me.
I want to close this series on mental health with an invitation. And this invitation is born from a question my own counselor asked me. I was having a particularly hard week on the mental health front a little bit ago. And it was one of those weeks where I felt like maybe my anxiety was the defining feature of my life, like there was no escape. In our session, for a while, I was talking to my counselor about how I was feeling. It's totally appropriate. But then she asked me what I was doing, and I told her some of the things that I'd been up to that week. I'd gotten out of bed each morning, albeit belligerently. I had eaten breakfast. I'd fed my kids. I'd managed to write an article and go to lunch with a friend. And as I shared this with her, we took a moment to celebrate all the ways I'd managed to show up for my life, even in small ways. Alan Noble just said something in this interview that has really stuck with me. He said, real peace is often an action more than a feeling. So often in our culture, we have this underlying belief system that we are what we feel. Our interior emotional world is the Rosetta Stone by which we translate all our other experiences, by which we measure the quality of our lives. Now, emotions do matter. They should not be ignored, and they are a vital part of our experience, but they are not the only part. My anxiety is not the sum total of who I am. I think that's what I'm trying to say. Yes, I am anxious. And also, I am a person who showed up for my kids. I am a person who loves my community. I am a person who planted that garden outside and made that meal on the table. And so my invitation for those of you who are struggling mightily today is this. I want to invite you to notice what is worth celebrating today. Where have you witnessed your own resilience, your own survival? Maybe it was that you simply watered your plants this morning. Maybe you took a shower. Maybe you showed up at work or hugged your kids or changed a diaper. Were you able to be present, even if uncomfortably so? Were you able to be present for your life with all its multifaceted beauty and mundaneness and wonder? And how does the love that surrounds you define you? Maybe even eclipse that shame you might feel about your struggles. How does God's love, the belovedness God bestows upon you, make you who you are? I'll close this series with a couple of my favorite verses from Psalm 18. In my distress, I called to the Lord. I cried to my God for help. From his temple, he heard my voice, and my cry came before him into his ears. He reached down from on high and took hold of me. He drew me out of deep waters. He brought me out into a spacious place. He rescued me because he delighted in me.